This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. Good morning. Coming up, another candidate in the Houston mayor's race, the politics behind boil water notices, who you marry, and how goods get to and from Houston. We discuss them all in this week's political roundup. Also, the tenuous future of cryptocurrency, and an Austin-based choral group heads our way to spread a little Christmas cheer. First, though, more than a year after the Astroworld Festival tragedy that killed 10 people and left hundreds injured, Harris County's approved a safety plan for future large-scale events. Commissioners unanimously approved the plan Tuesday. City Council's taking it up next as soon as today. It was drafted by the Houston-Harris County Special Events Task Force formed in the wake of the Astroworld Festival deaths. News 88.7's Lucio Vasquez is here with more. Hi, Lucio.
Hi, Craig. How you doing?
What more can you tell us about the safety plan itself?
Yeah, it applies to any event with 6,000 or more people attending. These events will have a unified command center and will also now require a medical or security plan to be reviewed and approved before the event takes place. Officials will also select representatives to have power to shut down the event if things get out of hand.
Now, this plan, as I understand it, only covers events at NRG Park. Why is that?
Yeah, they're viewing this as more of a pilot agreement before making a more large-scale agreement for county events down the road. What that agreement looks like remains to be seen.
Who makes up this task force?
Yeah, that'll be city and county officials like Houston Police Chief Troy Finner, Houston Fire Chief Samuel Pena, and Perry Turner, the Harris County's Deputy Chief Administrator for Justice and Safety.
But they're not the only members of this task force, right?
No, these are just a few that I just decided to include. Just
okay.
Now, I believe about 10 members.
And the others are representatives of the organizations
yeah,
that are involved in events and so forth?
Yes, yeah. There's a couple of other organizations being represented, like the Mayor's Office on Special Events. We've got the Event Safety Alliance for the city, as well as people who are representing events like the Houston County Sports and Convention Corporation and the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo for the county.
Commissioners Court approved the safety plan unanimously Tuesday. Did county commissioners have anything to say about it?
Yeah, Commissioner Adrian Garcia said the plan spells out everyone's jobs and should prevent things from falling through the cracks. He acknowledged that while the NRG Park agreement is a pilot location, he hopes that this can be implemented for future events sometime down the line.
And City Council is expected potentially to vote on the safety plan as soon as today. Should we expect council members to approve it?
I believe so, although it is important to make the distinction that they're approving a separate plan for private property events within the city with attendance of 500 or more people. The county-city agreement that it was approved yesterday doesn't actually need the city council approval.
Ah, okay. So they're going to vote on a separate one for other kinds of events within the city of Houston, and then the county will ultimately have some other plan to vote on for county-exclusive events. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
Okay. You spoke with a crowd management expert about the draft safety plan for these combined city-county events at NRG Park. What did he have to say about it?
Yeah, everything he said wasn't exactly positive, I will say. I spoke with Paul Wartheimer, a crowd safety expert with crowd management strategies, excuse me. He's been essentially studying crowd behavior for the last four decades, I believe. He said he doesn't think the new agreement will provide safety that is needed to control big crowds, and he felt that more effort could have been put into the agreement due to how long it took to put together. I mean, we are more than a year after the tragedy itself. I will say this is also a pilot agreement, so we could see more detailed, details in the more universal agreement down the line.
Yeah, I guess the other thing to point out there is that if there is an agreement in place that is sort of bare minimum, it doesn't mean that they couldn't exceed it potentially with security for future events. News 88.7's Lucio Vasquez, thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg.
And up next, another mayoral candidate for Houston, the politics of railroads, same-sex marriage, and boil water notices, and a whole lot more in our weekly political roundup. That's coming up as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. There's another candidate in the Houston mayor's race. The Senate passes a bill codifying same-sex and interracial marriages. President Biden urges Congress to approve an agreement between rail workers and operators to avoid a strike. And some questions linger about whether the city of Houston should have acted a bit more quickly to issue that boil water notice. To discuss those and other developments in our regular Wednesday political roundup, let's talk now with University of Houston Associate Professors of Political Science Beth Seamus and Geronimo Cortina. Geronimo is also co-host of our Party Politics program. Geronimo, Beth, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Geronimo, let me start with you. Do you see any political fallout from Monday's boil water notice?
Well, I mean, not for the mayor, because as you said, we have a mayoral race next year. I think that, as usual, you know, there's technical questions in terms if the announcement should have gone out earlier, before, faster, so on and so forth, right? So it's a matter of perception to some extent. Obviously, for some, it's going to be an opportunity once again to highlight faults in a particular administration. City council members, some of them complained that, you know, the announcement should have gone further or not. As I understand the issue, you know, the notice of boiling water was in terms of a precaution rather than a real situation. I mean, I'm not saying that it was not real, but that's what we have been told by, you know, local authorities, that it was just an abundance of caution in terms of not getting anybody sick.
Yeah, it did take the city several hours after this apparent brief power failure water treatment plan to issue this notice while they worked out what they were legally required to do. Beth, what do you think? Should city officials have known and moved faster to issue that notice, or is this just maybe a good exercise for some future instance that could be more serious?
I think it's the latter. You know, having a large city like Houston go on a boil water notice, that's a big decision. And so I think they were just being very careful not to rush into making such a decision. You know, we see the impact that this has on restaurants, on businesses, having to close schools. So, you know, I think it's a good thing that our city doesn't just rush into doing something like that. But, you know, again, could the response and could the communication have been better? Perhaps. But I agree, you know, it's a difficult thing that if you start communicating a little bit, then you create confusion, you create panic. So ultimately, I think, you know, these procedures need to be looked at, but exercising some caution and really making an educated decision isn't always the worst thing.
Geronimo, you alluded to the fact that Mayor Turner is term limited. The Houston mayor's race for this coming year has another candidate. State Senator John Whitmire officially announced his plans to run, though I think we already had a sense that that was going to happen. Former County Clerk Chris Hollins has announced he's running. Former Councilmember Amanda Edwards as well, among other announced candidates so far. What do you make of the field?
Well, it's going to be extremely interesting, right? Senator Whitmire, it's you know, a moderate Democrat. And, you know, since he has been in the state legislature since 1972, he has been working on both sides of the aisle. He has been praised by having a bipartisan, I guess, modus operandi in the state legislature. He's well respected. He has a ton of money so far, $9.5 million in his war chest, getting ready for the campaign. And then on the other hand, obviously, one of the most important ones are going to be Chris Hollins, right? That represents, to a certain extent, a different view in terms of how the city should be run. He's more progressive. He comes from the Democratic Party, more progressive wing. As former Harris County clerk, he implemented a lot of the new ways for people to vote, 24 hours voting location, so on and so forth. So it's going to be an interesting race. And then you have, obviously, Amanda Edwards that brings to the table the experience of being a member of city council, knows how the city operates. So it's going to be very, very interesting race. And we still need to know who else is going to be running pretty soon.
Beth Seamus, what do you make of the field? What are your observations of all of this?
Well, you know, I think it's going to be interesting. It's playing out to be expensive, as Hieronimo said. You know, it's interesting to note that Whitmire launched his bid, you know, with the help of Tillman Fertitta. And, you know, that's obviously a big name and a big power in Houston. So that's going to, you know, do a lot for possibly sending some signals about the type of leadership we'd get. But, I think these issues are going to, that we were talking about with water, with infrastructure, with voting, these are going to be the major issues. And, you know, I think Whitmire is going to emerge as the front runner so far, but it's still, you know, about a year out. So it's hard to tell.
Hieronimo, how will this likely compare to the 2015 campaign field of 7 or 8 that led to Mayor Turner's election?
Well, I think, once again, having such amount of money that Whitmire already has, that's going to put a threshold in terms of who's going to be able to compete or not. Having that amount of money sometimes deters potential candidates to run because that means that the campaign is going to be extremely expensive. Also, you know, there's going to be a lot of politics involved. There's going to be a lot of issues involved. Other issues are going to be related to public safety. That's going to be on top of voters' minds, especially when the campaign trail starts. And there's also, as Beth said, issues about infrastructure, issues about resilience, and issues in terms of regarding urban development, new development, so on and so forth. So it's going to be interesting, it's going to be expensive, and it's going to draw a lot of people eventually if they have the amount of support to compete in such a race.
You know, Beth, the political world in 2015 was quite different. And I think back to how the mayoral campaign played out and the announced candidates coordinated their schedules. And there were a high number of candidate forums, and most, if not all of them, attended nearly every one. And I wonder if we're in a different environment now where that's less likely.
You know, again, I think it's going to really shape up more as we go on and see how this campaign plays out, if it's going to get nasty, if it's going to get, you know, sort of divisive like that. But I could see, you know, if you are the front runner like Whitmire with the money, you would have an incentive not to engage in these kinds of forums because then you're just simply giving a platform and exposure to individuals who are not as well funded as you are. So, you know, there's certainly that incentive there. But, you know, given Whitmire's experience and record as, you know, such as long record in politics, you know, I also could see him wanting to engage in those kinds of forums. But again, I think it's going to come down to sort of the tone that the campaigns take when approaching one another.
This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. It's our weekly political roundup today with University of Houston Associate Professors of Political Science Beth Seamus and Hieronimo Cortina. Hieronimo, on Tuesday, the U.S. Senate passed the Respect for Marriage Act on a 61-36 vote. This codifies same-sex and interracial marriages, requiring all states to recognize them performed in any other state. It does not require the states themselves to allow them to be performed. Why not take that step as well?
Well, obviously, the Senate needed a couple of voters, senators from the Republican Party. So I think that they got 12 senators supporting this piece of legislation. And that signals that there had to be some compromise between Democrats and Republicans in the Senate. So that's one issue, right? Because you wanted to obviously avoid having a filibuster thread. So once you get 12 senators over there, you need to have some compromise. And I think that was part of the compromise. There was a lot of negotiations behind the scenes between Democrats and Republicans. And I think that this was a good compromise. And also, it's, you know, a preventive measure in terms of what the Supreme Court might or might not do eventually in the future. Clarence Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas, signal once we have taken down Roe versus Wade, that Overhill versus Hodges had the same legal logic. So that sounded the alarm, and immediately people started working. And I think this is a response of that signaling that Justice Thomas did once he had his concurrent opinion on such a case.
Yeah. In passing it, Senator Chuck Schumer said it was, quote, sending a message that every senator needs to hear, that no matter who you are or who you love, you too deserve dignity and equal treatment under the law. Beth, I'm wondering, though, if he said every senator needs to hear, but I wonder if the message was really that every Supreme Court justice needs to hear, at least from Schumer's perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, this was somewhat peremptory of saying, no, we're not going to allow this to happen, though I don't know that the court actually would have gone there. You know, public opinion on same-sex marriage has just really changed and become so much more supportive over time. And that's in contrast to abortion, which has stayed very much divided even since the 70s and since Roe. So, you know, while the court has its own agenda, I do think it does have a little bit of a sense of what the people will stand and bear. And so I don't know that that was actually a legitimate threat from the court, but either way, this was something that the Schumer and the Democrats did to really show that they're not just going to allow the courts to, you know, do whatever they want.
Geronimo, this bill heads to the House, where it is expected to be passed quickly and then sent to President Biden for his signature. There is the potential, though, that the Supreme Court could hear a challenge to this law on some constitutional ground and strike it down at some point if the High Court so chooses. Could there be five justices who agree with Justice Thomas's concurrent opinion and would want to see that happen?
I mean, yes. I mean, no one thought eventually, right? A year ago, no one thought that Roe versus Wade was going to be turned down. And here we are. You know, 50 years has been the law of the land, and suddenly it's sent back to the states. So potentially, I mean, the issue once again is this issue of public opinion. And if the courts want to get head to head with another power, with another branch of government, and this would be, you know, the legislative branch. And I don't think that, you know, the court has the appetite to be confronting, right, the will of the people through these representative democracy in such a obvious way. If there is a challenge, right, remember that the Supreme Court has, you know, all the right to say, I'm going to take this case or I'm not going to take this case. So they can just avoid it by simply not taking any cases such as that. But I think that such a confrontation would be perhaps something unlikely. But again, I don't want to make any predictions, because with the composition of the Supreme Court, you never know.
I'm not sure no one thought Roe would be overturned a year ago.
No.
I think there were plenty of folks who were sounding that warning back in the 2016 campaign, that that's what that election may have been about. The House is expected, Beth, to vote today on a tentative agreement between railroad workers and operators to avoid a rail strike. President Biden Tuesday said such a strike is likely without congressional action. While the House may pass it, it is not clear if there are 60 votes in the Senate for it. What happens if there is not? What are the potential implications of a rail strike on our economy?
They're pretty dire. But because of that hurdle in the Senate, I think the House is doing something a little bit interesting. They're using procedure to break this vote into two pieces. And so one piece of it would just approve the labor agreement. And then the second piece that would offer a paid leave to rail workers doesn't actually have to go through the Senate. And that's the more objectionable piece, where I think they would have really run into that 60 vote limit. So because they've taken advantage of these sort of procedural loopholes, if you will, you know, it does look like we will avoid this, but it could be very bad for our economy. And, you know, this is they're the veins, the railroad's the veins, right? And how things run and move. And so, like I said, it would be a very serious thing, but it's looking at like this somewhat procedural loophole is going to allow these things to move through because the Senate won't be needed for that more controversial component of the bill.
Yeah, if our railways are our veins, imagine for a moment what it would mean for the capillaries we all drive on day if that's the way we had to get goods to and from and we didn't have rail as an option. As NPR's Dustin Jones reported Tuesday, House and Senate Republicans in recent days have been speaking out against former President Donald Trump's dinner last week with Ye, the rapper formerly known as Kanye West, and white nationalist and Holocaust denier Nick Fuentes. Among those speaking out, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. McConnell said, quote, there is no room in the Republican Party for anti-Semitism or white supremacy, and that, quote, anyone meeting with people advocating that point of view, in my judgment, are highly unlikely to ever be elected president of the United States. McCarthy said Fuentes has no place in this Republican Party, and then erroneously claimed the former president had condemned Fuentes four times. Former President Trump did make at least four statements about the dinner, each time saying he had not known Fuentes, and only on a fifth statement did he say that Fuentes did not express his views at the dinner, and if he had, quote, it wouldn't have been accepted. That is the closest Trump has come to criticizing Fuentes. All right. Geronimo, what do you see as the political implications, if any, of all of this?
Well, it's another one that highlights or gives the Republican Party the opportunity to have a clean break with President Trump. I think that the issue here is once again, former President Trump has made very, erroneous judgments in terms of who to meet or not to meet. There's a lot of speculation why the dinner happened. Apparently, Ye or Kanye West is running for president in 2024. So apparently and allegedly, because we don't know the content, he was asking former President Trump to be his vice president. Yes. So there's a lot of speculation.
My vacation is over right now.
Exactly. So you missed that one.
I did.
So again, gives opportunity for the Republican Party to make a clear break from President Trump and leave him alone. And this is in addition, right, to the Mar-a-Lago investigation. This is in addition of the Department of Justice designating a special counsel to have that. This is in addition to January 6th investigation, and obviously in addition to what happened yesterday in terms of finding the leader of the Oath Keepers guilty of seditious activity. So there is a lot of going on, and I think that, you know, this is one of the times that we have seen the Republican leadership in Congress, right, being, you know, very, very clear, especially Senator Mitch McConnell. Kevin McCarthy did not, highlighted President Trump as clear as McConnell. But I think, you know, that's what we're seeing here. And perhaps they're going to have a clean break and then you're on your own.
Beth, our Andrew Schneider reported last week that two Houston area congressmen are vying for committee chairmanships in the next Congress. Texas 10th District Congressman Michael McCaul is the ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Texas 2nd District Congressman Dan Crenshaw wants to lead the House Homeland Security Committee. What are the chances for each?
The chances for McCaul look pretty good as of right now, being a ranking member. So the way these are decided generally is a lot by seniority. And so in that case, it's a pretty clear path for McCaul to take over the House Foreign Affairs Committee and to take the chairman's gavel. For Crenshaw, it's probably a little bit of a longer shot. Again, it's a matter of seniority. I think he's only the third ranking member among Republicans, and it looks like he is going to have competition from Congressman Clay Higgins in Louisiana, who has been on that committee. So actually, I take that back. Higgins is the third ranking Republican. So again, it's a matter of seniority, and it seems like Crenshaw simply doesn't have it at this point. So, you know, it's just something that Texas is going through in general with so many retirements that Texas has had. We just see that a lot of the House members from Texas, although they maybe have a lot of power and clout in other ways as far as publicity and fundraising, they just don't have the seniority. And that's it. Just the general procedure in the House is you have to get in line.
Beth Seamus and Geronimo Cortina are associate professors of political science at the University of Houston. Geronimo is also co-host of our Party Politics program. Check it out Friday nights at 7:30 here on News 88.7 or wherever you get your podcasts. Beth, Geronimo, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just ahead, the recent collapse of some major players in the sector of cryptocurrency reinforces long-standing questions about its viability. We discuss as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. First, the cryptocurrency exchange FTX collapses. Then, this week, the crypto financing firm BlockFi files for bankruptcy. Many of their customers will lose most, if not all, of their money. Suddenly, those who were telling us all to invest in cryptocurrency, well, they've largely gone silent. But are these recent developments a sign of the end of crypto altogether or merely the inevitable collapse of some sketchy companies in an unregulated market? Rice University adjunct professor in management Manolo Sanchez tells Houston Matters' William Menjivar why he believes cryptocurrency is likely here to stay.
FTX Trading is a cryptocurrency exchange firm. What exactly does the company do?
There's basically several companies that that created this situation within this galaxy, if you will. And so FTX is a decentralized exchange. So like many of the companies that are very well known, Coinbase or Kraken, basically these are companies where you can purchase cryptocurrency with fiat money, with US dollars or other legal tender currencies in different countries, or you can exchange different cryptocurrencies. But there, you're not doing these transactions in the native blockchains. You're going through an intermediary. So you can either trade them or you can actually have these exchanges hold those currencies for you. So they provide implicitly custodial services. That's what one of the issues that created the problem at FTX is they were holding assets for their clients. And it appears that they were also using those funds to speculate with another sister company that they have called Alameda Research, which is a trading company that was taking, like, think of it as a hedge fund, a company that was basically using exposure, was making trades to obviously try to make gains by trading cryptocurrencies for their own account, for their own benefit, if you will. But some investors were also participating in that. So that's the general theme. Just think about it as it's not really a broker, but it's the closest thing would be like a brokerage kind of system.
Can you explain why FTX Trading filed for bankruptcy?
It looks like there may have been some accounting fraud, and basically at one point there was a mismatch between their assets and liabilities, and they had to, as the creditors are trying to, you know, take control of the assets, they basically you stop the music, and you know, you get a judge or a court to actually decide who gets what of what's left, right? And so that's why they filed for bankruptcy, to protect assets and themselves at one point. The question is why they get to that point. And what's also important to understand about FTX, and in addition to those two companies I talked about, the exchange and the trading company, there was a token, a native, what's called a governance token. So you can, when you create a company, a crypto company, it doesn't have to have necessarily a monetary purpose, but like this particular is a financial services company, you can create a token that powers somewhat the company itself. There are different formulas. You can do a security token or a utility token, and sometimes you can create a governance token. And this is what happened with FTX. Unlike Coinbase or Kraken, for example, to name two exchanges that do not have a governance token, FTX did have its own token, and they were using that token, which is issued by themselves. Think about it as a stock, or it's really not a stock, but it's a proxy for it. Really, it's a governing rights. They're selling governing rights into the exchange, and they were actually leveraging that token called FTT. That token was trading and a lot of people owned it. Venture capital firms that are original to the funding, competitors like Binance were owning it. And they themselves apparently were playing with their own token to make collateral, to actually bet, make bigger bets on that. And that's really what, that was actually the, one of the actual mechanism that triggered the bankruptcy and the short, the run on the company as Binance kind of delisted, but didn't delist it, but they decided to announce they were going to sell the FTT token. And then that created a huge liquidity crunch on them, on that token and on the company.
So what's happened to the customers, if I may ask? What will happen to them? What will happen to those who bought into that coin?
Well, if you bought that FTT token, basically you were, I mean, that's the first thing when people, I tell my students is you have to know what, do your own homework in crypto. It's very important. But it's, governance tokens are a world of their own because they're, as I mentioned earlier, that this is a monetization of governing rights, which is a pretty surreal, concept. You're buying a right to vote basically in a company. So it's like if you split the economic and the political rights within a corporation, say that Apple would have two stocks, one for voting for their governance and one for getting the economics dividends, if you will, right? So this company had that token, which the value of it would be very, you know, hard to pin down in a highly volatile world. But that's what the investors were buying when they were buying the token. Right. So, high risk, highly speculative. And then there was also a big gap between, the actual holdings of it. There seemed to be a lot of reserve tokens that were being held by FTX itself. So the valuation was, a bit of a mystery in and of itself. In fact, that's what blew up the whole, this situation blew up when there was a leak on the balance sheet of Alameda Research, and people saw that a big chunk of the assets Alameda had, or Alameda, were basically the FTT token. And that's when people started really being
concerned. So it was pouring a valuation from one company into another.
Yeah, and using instruments are very innovative, but therefore also very new, very hard to comprehend. And they also have a lot of loopholes, if you will. These are new paradigms entirely. I mean, you know, for people that are not initiated in cryptocurrencies, this is probably one of the most complicated. We're in the third derivative of this concept. But so FTX had all of it, if you will, right? They had, a company that probably, commingled funds from, they're not depositors, but they had their custodian of their assets. They also, used those funds, to make huge bets. And then they actually bet on their own, if you will, stock or byproduct, one of their governance tools. So it became a big mess, as you can see.
Bitcoin hit an all-time high valuation of over $60,000 last year. It has since taken a quite dramatic fall and is valued at a lot less, around $16,000 or so right now. Why did the price of crypto take such a hit over the last year?
Yeah, I mean, it was the total market cap of all cryptos is about 21,000 cryptos right now, which is incredible. Of them, the majority are tokens within the Ethereum network, so there are sub-tokens within the big highway. But, $3 trillion unheard of, and that's down to 600 billion. So a lot of value has been wiped out. I think the valuation is, I mean, it's a big drama, and a lot of people have lost a lot of wealth here, but I focus more on what it, you know, the kind of solution that crypto brings is the infrastructure of native money and internet. And the issues that it's from being basically an infrastructure play, which is kind of a utility at its ultimate place. But what has happened is that all this speculation on it and the valuations are very hard. I think I advise people to really understand what's the relevance of cryptocurrencies and blockchains, and then separate that from the issue of for value, because the value part is very related to supply and demand. You're missing out on many other dynamics that you know, there's very, in fact, most of the evaluation is very hard. It's non-traditional. There's no discounted cash flows. There's no intrinsic value in these things. So, but what's important to understand is what is the power of this technology and how far, how big does it get? And that's when I think time was spent to understand really how this value of the internet, this highway for value in the internet is kind of really here to stay, because there's no native money to the internet. We have to plug onto traditional payment systems, which are very antiquated. I mean, like, you know, versus a native programmable digital money, which is what this cryptocurrencies bring to the table.
Do you think that the people that are buying into cryptocurrencies now, you know, it's I feel like cryptocurrency has come into the mainstream. We're seeing commercials during the Super Bowl and people buying coins through these exchange firms. But do you think that's why they're buying into it and not just the reward of reaping the reward of the value, you know, potential value that it may have?
Yeah, I mean, there's some of that. I mean, it's always been very speculative. You can envision that this is a nascent technology, that this could things are getting very big, and people want to make bets on this. So that's what it would explain for people, the rush to that. But there's been other dynamics, as you probably know. I mean, as you know well, the pandemic and the pandemic rescue packages, if you will, the $3 to $4 trillion worth of money thrown into our economy, U.S. alone. There was an inflation that we're seeing right now. There was a time where this cryptocurrency, particularly Bitcoin, was seen as a reserve asset. Kind of, it was called a digital gold. And some of that has played out. In fact, if you listen to companies like MicroStrategies, even some folks that were talking in corporate America about holding Bitcoin, they were talking about having a hedge against inflation using a scarce asset like this one. So there have been many dynamics, but I would say speculation. Let's rest assured that that's actually one of the big drivers of this process, and therefore the volatility has been so incredibly, crazy in so many different ways.
With the collapse of FTX trading, do you see more regulations for cryptocurrency coming from the federal government?
Well, Bitcoin is deemed to be a commodity as per the U.S. rules. Well, I would say two things. One, you know, these are hybrids. You know, a lot of folks in the U.S. in particular, because our securities laws were written in the 30s and they haven't really evolved, have been adapted for the internet. So these are hybrids. Europe has taken a more, more forward-looking approach, but they have an easier legislative process to adapt their rules. So they call this instruments qualified financial instruments, and they're in hybrids. So they're stock, and they're also a utility token, for example, or they could say it's a combination of both. So the regulation is needed, but you don't want to stifle this innovation, because a lot of regulation, in particular the ones around securities, are pre-internet, and so they need to change. The regulations around protection of consumers and you know, they definitely, I think for U.S. domicile stablecoin companies, I think the U.S. prudential regulators are thinking about regulating these companies. That makes sense too. I mean, ultimately, these are companies that are born in a world that's libertarian by design, that's just to be censorship resistant and government free. And I think the way that if I had my will, I would try to compete against this. For example, stablecoins, we don't have a central bank digital currency in the U.S. And there seems to be no desire to launch one. But it would take a lot of the wind out of the sails if the U.S. sort of, the U.S. government, the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank would bring us to the 21st century, bringing us digital currencies. And you know, because there's no alternative, right? You have to go through this sort of outer galaxy world to interact with the future. We have no alternative, because the traditional banks and the traditional regulatory system haven't given us digital digital currencies. There's been a presidential executive order around the kind of homework that should be done by the agencies to seek out for some recommendations. The Fed has put out a paper saying, you know, if we have the endorsement of Congress and the executive arm says that we should do this, we will do it. So there may be a lack of leadership at this point around who is responsible for what, but you know, first you have other countries that have digital currencies are going to roll out digital currencies before we do, and two, this legit digital currencies could bring more order and than this Wild West that we're seeing, because you know, we would have an alternative, this, you know, like full faith and credit, if you will, of the U.S. Treasury or the Federal Reserve Bank. So I think that it's like most things we've seen really with this whole fintech revolution, you know, things like Venmo or some of the payment innovations we've seen over the last decade in the U.S. in particular has been driven by private sector, but the Fed has kind of missed an opportunity to be there and probably would have created a greater utility highway, a public service highway versus all this private highways that we have.
Manolo Sanchez is adjunct professor in management at Rice University. He spoke with Houston Matters' William Minhivar. An Austin-based choral group brings its annual Christmas concert to Houston. That's next. Stay with us as Houston Matters continues. December begins tomorrow. Wow, that happened fast. 'Tis the season for holiday decorations, shopping, merriment, and a lot of choral music, including an annual Christmas concert from Austin-based choral group Conspirare. Its holiday performance is Friday night at St. Luke's United Methodist Church. Here's a brief snippet from Conspirare's 2021 Christmas concert. Conspirare performing last year's Christmas concert here in Houston. Joining us now is the Grammy Award-nominated ensemble's founding artistic director, Craig Hella Johnson. Craig, welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you so much. It's sure great to be with you.
What should those who have never attended a Conspirare concert know about the choir?
Well, you know, this is a beautiful time of year. It seems like December is really a singing season. It's Conspirare, with this program that started kind of as the anti-tradition many years ago, meaning just wanted to keep this concert fresh that we would do every year and not kind of get into old patterns and ruts. It's become this really kind of beloved, cherished thing that we do now. We create a real collage of music with the idea that we'll create an experience for people that can be very unifying and very grounding, very uplifting, we hope, for people. So music from across the spectrum. You know, Conspirare is at the base, a classical choir, so that's kind of our home turf. But we travel in all kinds of music, and so this program is really a big journey, really meant to just be a huge invitation to everybody to say, remember who we are, our human family. Let's get back in touch, return to each other in this season of love. You know, it's always a very fresh and fun concert.
How and when did you first come together?
Gosh, Conspirare has been around for about 28 years. So we've been doing our thing for a long time here in Central Texas. This concert, I think the series is about probably 19 years old now, and started out in this tiny little intimate chapel in West Austin. About 120 people is all it could seat, but it was a very magical time. And now this has grown to a concert that's, when we're in Austin, we have about 2,300 folks there. And when we bring it to other places, it's a much larger venture, but it still has at the core this very intimate feeling.
What would you say separates Conspirare from other choral groups?
Gosh, there's so much great music making going on. And of course, in Houston, just so many fabulous choral groups, too. So we love coming there. I love Houston as a musical city. But I'd say, you know, contemporary, for me, I just see these artists who come from across the country. Singers come from all over the United States to become contemporary 5 or 6 times a year, like we're doing. And one of the things that is remarkable about this group of singers and artists is how generous they are. You know, they're seasoned pros kind of singing at the top of their game. And yet they're just incredibly generous and open, and they're in it for kind of bigger purposes than just the performance itself. They really, I get this feeling like they understand we're serving something larger than ourselves, which is really beautiful.
Well, what do you mean by serving something larger than yourselves? In what way?
Well, you know, we're living in a time right now where we all just as humans seem so separate from one another in hundreds of ways, it seems. And, you know, we all find our places to kind of be across the river from one another, if you will. And there's a larger purpose of reminding us why we're here on this earth at all, who we are as human beings, and not just functioning in our daily routines, but remembering that we actually have a deep connection with one another, like a global human family, and that at the core, we're all born out of a loving instinct. And so I think that's what I mean, is that we're serving that larger idea that there's something much larger than the ways we view our separation on a daily basis.
Are there some songs that you perform in this or in other concerts that you would say reflect that particular theme?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the whole program is set up not sort of just as holiday entertainment, but really as a kind of soul-searching journey. The whole first maybe 25-30% of the program really kind of lives into this separation. One of the things we love to do is to take old ancient things. Like we start out the very beginning of the program with the old chant, Veni Emmanuel, which many people know, Come, O Come Emmanuel, from the Christian tradition. But we merge that with the Stevie Nicks song, Edge of 17, and the words kind of just merge across the centuries. So those kinds of things we do all the time. We've commissioned new works for this. And so there are things that people will hear that are totally familiar to them, but also things that'll take them out into brand new places as well.
Can you give one example of a new work that you think would be exciting for attendees to hear?
Yeah. You know, we have a new piece called Joyful. And this is by Deke Sharon. It's a short work, but it's a cool text because it's a text by both Helen Keller and Annie Sullivan, and was her teacher. Helen Keller, of course, this speaks about this incredible moment of joy when Helen Keller, who many may remember, was this young child who was blind and deaf and could not speak. And when her teacher and Helen had this breakthrough of understanding. So that's kind of this moment of joy through so much darkness. And Deke is somebody who writes, for a lot of the big shows like Sing Off and the Perfect Pitch movies. He was, you know, deeply involved in doing all the musical settings and arrangements for that. So that's one of the cool new pieces. We've also got a couple of new arrangements by Blake Morgan. And Blake is a part of the beautiful ensemble Voces 8, which I think comes back to Houston at least once every couple of years and is much loved by Houston folks.
Conspirare performs its Christmas concert Friday night at 7:30 at St. Luke's United Methodist Church here in Houston. We have a link to more information in today's post at HoustonMatters.org. Craig Hella Johnson is the ensemble's founding artistic director. Craig, thank you very much. Happy holidays.
Hey, thanks. Same to you. Thank you so much.
And that will do it for today's show. The Houston Matters team includes Michael Haggerty, Joshua Zinn, Troy Schultz, and William Menhivar. Jared Carroll's our technical director. On tomorrow's show, another touring group, the Blind Boys of Alabama. They're bringing their Christmas show to Jones Hall this weekend. We will talk with one of the members of the band. Also, with Steven Spielberg's new film, The Fablemans, now in theaters, we remember his first feature film shot in the Houston area, the 1974 crime drama, The Sugarland Express. I'm Craig Cohen. Join us tomorrow for those and other Houston Matters.